Welcome to this Ufula audio production of The Lone Ranger Rides by Fran Stryker. Volume 5, Chapter 14, The Trail Leads Down. When Rangoon was tied, the Lone Ranger dragged him across the clearing and placed him with his back propped against a tree.
"You'll probably be here for some time," he said. "I'll take that gag out of your mouth if you can keep quiet."
The gag removed, the masked man studied Rangoon's face for a full minute.
"What's your name?"
he asked. Rangoon glared darkly from beneath the connected eyebrows. His mouth, already distorted somewhat by the scar on his cheek, was drawn even further back when he said in a slow voice that fairly dripped with hate,
"You go to hell."
Penny spoke up.
"He calls himself Rangoon."
The Lone Ranger nodded.
"Seems to me that I've seen him when he had another name."
He turned to Penelope.
"You, of course, are Penelope Cavendish,"
he said more as a statement than a question. The girl nodded while her eyes remained fixed on the face beneath the mask, and the mask itself. She hadn't noticed the slight limp when the Lone Ranger walked. The shoulder bandage was covered by his shirt. Her feeling was one of admiration and gratitude, but most of all, resentment. She felt that Tonto had misled her. It was inconceivable that the man before her could so recently have been desperately in need of food. He didn't look helpless. He certainly hadn't acted helpless when he saw Rangoon. Yet Tonto had implied that his plight was serious. Perhaps need of concealment and not starvation had kept the masked man hidden while Tonto sought food. Though Penny liked his voice and manner and the way he handled Rangoon, she could judge him only by the facts and circumstances. He had come to the clearing. Rangoon was in the clearing. Wasn't it obvious that they had come here to meet? Rangoon, known as an outlaw, and the newcomer masked. True, the masked man had fired at Rangoon while Rangoon fired at him, but wasn't this perhaps an act for her benefit? Neither man was injured, and these were the facts. To Tonto, Penny said,
"I didn't know your friend was an outlaw."
Tonto began to speak, but Penny continued,
"If I had, I certainly wouldn't have brought him food for you to take to him."
The Lone Ranger spoke quickly.
"Are you the one who brought Tonto that food?"
"Of course. Didn't he tell you?"
"No,"
said the masked man, glancing at Tonto.
"He did not."
Tonto was highly uncomfortable.
"If I had known where that food had come from, I might not have..."
"I suppose," interrupted Penny, "the fact that you had food from the Cavendish family complicates things for you."
The Lone Ranger looked at the girl somewhat surprised. She went on speaking slowly and significantly.
"It must make it a trifle difficult for you to go ahead with your plans."
Could Penelope know his plans and suspicions? The masked man tried to fathom the enigmatic expression on the girl's face. Did she know that he felt a strong suspicion that her uncle was hiring crooks to bring stolen cattle to the basin? Did she realize that his purpose was to fix the guilt of murder on basin killers? He said,
"It might make everything more complicated than you realize, Miss Cavendish."
He took a step toward her.
"I want you to understand one thing, though."
"Oh, please."
There was annoyance in the girl's tone.
"Don't let's talk any further. You've helped me, and if you feel that I helped you, we're square. I'd sooner let it go at that and start for home."
"It can't go at that,"
the Lone Ranger said decisively.
"The fact that you saved my life puts me in a peculiar position."
He drew a cartridge from his belt.
"Take this,"
he said, offering the bullet.
"And if there's any man in the world whose life means a great deal to you, tell him to carry it at all times."
Penny looked at the silver bullet in the palm of the masked man's hand.
"Silver?"
she asked curiously, despite herself.
"Yes."
"So you want to repay me by agreeing to spare one life?"
She drew up proudly.
"Keep your bullet. We're quite able to defend ourselves against you. Thank you very much."
Turning abruptly, she mounted Las Vegas and rode quickly away. As Penelope guided Las Vegas downhill, she felt as if a buoyant hope had been punctured to sink into a black sea of despair. Her confidence in Tonto had been great, and despite what she had heard about the murder of the Texas Rangers, some tiny voice far deep inside her kept whispering that she should count on the man whom the Indian called friend. She had to count on somebody. Yuma thought that her uncle was a leader of killers. Penny felt otherwise. She had hoped somehow to find a strong, staunch friend who would feel as she did. Seeing Tonto's friend, she saw a masked man, a man who offered to spare the life of one she loved most in order to repay her for food. Now she had no one to turn to but Bryant Cavendish. Stubborn, bitter, unreasonable old man that he was, he'd have to listen to her. He must be made to understand that forces were piling up in his own home against him. He must be shown that Mort and Vince were scheming with Rangoon, perhaps with others, taking orders from an unknown chief, ambushing Texas Rangers, murdering and heaven only knew what else. Bryant must be made to understand that his own life was probably in danger, and must send word out for lawmen, many lawmen, to come and help. Becky had got word to the Texas Rangers. Bryant must find and use the same means, but this time they had to reach the basin without being ambushed. Bryant would be hard to talk to, but the time for diplomacy and handling him was past. She rode on, not knowing that old Gimlet was waiting for her with stunning news. Meanwhile, instead of replacing the silver bullet in his cartridge belt, the Lone Ranger put it in his pocket. He drew the Indian aside, out of the hearing of Rangoon. "Don't you see the spot that we're in now, Tonto? If Brian Cavendish is in charge of the basin, as he's always been, he's the man we want. I'm alive to get him only because of what his niece did for me. She may have given me a life that I've dedicated to the hanging of the man she cares for. I've got to know her feelings." Tonto nodded his agreement, looking quite dejected. "I don't think Bryant himself did the killing, Tonto, but unless things have changed since the last reports came out of Bryant's basin, he rules his little kingdom with a mailed fist, and there isn't a thing that goes on there he doesn't order. If killers are there, he brought them there. The Texas Rangers must have died because Bryant Cavendish sent out men to kill them." Tonto studied the tall man's eyes and noted there was a new intensity in the great depths.
"Maybe now we make camp," said Tonto. "You need rest."
"There isn't time to rest now, Tonto. Penelope Cavendish believes I'm one of the outlaws. If she thinks Bryant is on the level and tells him about seeing me, he'll make things hot. We've got to strike before he can act. It'll soon be dark enough to get to the Cavendish house without being seen. I'm going there. Cavendish is an old man. At best, he hasn't many years to live. His niece, if she loves him, can keep him. But we're going to take the killers that work for him, and he's going to give us the evidence that'll hang them." The Lone Ranger spoke softly, but with a calm determination that told Tonto there was little use in trying to persuade him to postpone a meeting in a murderer's retreat. "What's more," the Lone Ranger finished, "he's going to put that evidence in writing."
"I will go with you," the Indian said. "We leave this Rangoon fellow tied here."
"No, Tonto, I'm going alone." Tonto tried to convince the Lone Ranger that he was risking his life, that he needed help, and that he shouldn't ride unaccompanied into the basin. But the masked man shook his head. "My plan is better, Tonto. We're going to leave Rangoon here, by the trail these men use in going from the basin to the outside. The first ones who come through here will find him. They'll release him, and there'll be some talk. I want Rangoon to think that both of us have ridden to the basin. We'll start out down the trail, but you'll turn back and hide nearby to hear what's said. I'll ride into the basin and have a showdown talk with Cavendish and meet you later in our cave in the gap." The masked man pointed out how Tonto's natural abilities made him the logical one to wait in the forest. No white man could maintain the vigil with absolute silence that was so imperative. On the other hand, the Indian's scant knowledge of white men's laws and courts of law made him a poor one to dictate the sort of statement that must be secured from Bryant Cavendish. The two returned to the proximity of Rangoon and made ready to start riding.
You can't leave me here,
the scar-faced outlaw shouted. The Lone Ranger looked at him and said deliberately,
Why not?
What if I starve? What if I'm ate up by animals?
That,
retorted the masked man,
would be easier than the way the Snake Flats homesteaders died when Abe Larkin killed them.
Rangoon's eyes went wide at the mention of the name he had formerly used and the people he had killed.
What do you know about them?
He cried.
The law is still keeping a noose ready for Abe Larkin.
Where y'all going?
There was panic now in Rangoon's voice as he saw the two mount and point their horses toward the basin. The Lone Ranger said,
Come on, Silver.
Rangoon tugged at his ropes, struggled with them until his wrists were almost bleeding. His courage as the darkness fell on the woodland clearing ebbed until he was reduced to a sniveling, sobbing wretch with scant resemblance to the swaggering monster that had bullied Penelope earlier.
Who?
He cried aloud.
Who was he? What in God's name was that masked man with the silver bullets? He called me Abe Larkin. Who in God's name was he?
Somewhere, unseen in the darkness, a crouching Indian grinned. Chapter 15. Intrigue Comes Closer. When Penny reached home just after dark, she noticed a peculiarly deserted air about the ranch. Most of the horses belonging to the cowboys were gone from the corral when she turned Las Vegas in. The shack where Becky had lived was dark, and the big house nearly so. There was one lamp burning in the living room, and the kitchen wing was lit. That was it. The usual bunkhouse sounds of laughter or murmuring voices against an occasional accordion or guitar background weren't there. Penelope entered by the kitchen door. Gimlet rose to greet her, with anxiety showing in every one of the innumerable lines on his battered old face.
"Gee-ripes!"
burst out Gimlet.
"Where you been?"
Penny was somewhat taken aback by the old man's obvious agitation.
"What's the matter, Gimlet? Is anything wrong?"
"That's just it. I don't know. Seems like all hell's due to bust loose. And yet, there ain't a thing I can put my finger on. These things been up, I tell you. I was damn scared near to death something happened to you."
"But why?"
"You sure everything's all right with you? You ain't met no trouble."
"What kind of trouble? Where is everybody?"
"I don't know what kind, just trouble. Trouble like being shot at or having threats made at you."
Penny shook her head.
"I rode quite a way and didn't realize it was so late. Where's Uncle Bryant?"
It was when Gimlet replied that Penny felt her first frustration.
"He's gone. God don't worry too, why?"
"Gone?"
echoed the girl.
"Didn't he say anything?"
"He come to the kitchen, told me to pack some victuals in a sack and stay while I done it. He took the sack, throwed it into the buckboard, had two strong horses all hitched, then fetched Mort out of the house with his neck still bandaged, and the two done drove off."
Penny hadn't known Bryant to leave the basin in years, yet she knew Gimlet must be telling the truth.
"Didn't he say when he was coming back?"
she asked.
"Not a damn word! Key rips!"
Penny had counted on a heart-to-heart talk with her uncle. Now that the talk was out of the question, at least for the time being, she felt a hopelessness that made her aware of how much she had counted on that talk.
"How long ago did Uncle Bryant leave?"
she asked.
"Just a little while after the argument."
"Argument? What argument?"
"Him and that cowboy calling himself Yuma had another sit-do."
"Yuma?"
In her confusion of emotions, Penny could do little more than echo what Gimlet had said.
"I tell you, craps! They've been things going on, but nothing I can lay my finger on. Bryant and Yuma talked low for a time, then both got to howling. I could hear some of what was said." You was called on Brian to see to it that Mort got what he deserved and got told to go to hell.
That's what Uncle Brian would tell him.
You even said he'd done some thinking since the last row they had and figured that if Mort wasn't giving what a killer should get, it was because Brian didn't give a damn what went on in the basin.
Oh, if Yuma could only understand Uncle Bryant, said Penny. Uncle Bryant can't be bulldozed into doing anything. One way to make certain he doesn't turn Mort over to the law is to order him to do it.
They had plenty of hot words, said Gimlet, shaking his head slowly. There was a heap of cussing on both sides. When I done heard what Bryant told about the shooting of Becky, I was fit to be tied. I was gall-durned mad.
What'd he say?
Asked Penny eagerly.
Said that Mort told him he never had no intent of shooting Becky.
Penny's lips compressed.
Mort claimed he'd seen a rattler, a snake, a big one. He was shooting at the rattler, but his shotgun went wild and through the window and got his wife.
So, said Penny softly, that's the story he's going to tell.
He told it, Brian told it, and I reckon it'll stand. Ain't no way to prove otherwise.
No,
responded the girl, her confidence in Uncle Bryant severely threatened.
There's no way to prove otherwise.
I saved some chow for you,
Gimlet said in an incidental way.
If you want it, I reckon you're hungry.
Penelope shook her head.
I'm not hungry, Gimlet.
I don't know what's going to happen,
the old man said sadly.
I do know one thing, though, that's just this. Becky wasn't killed by no accident. If Brian says she was, he's as big a damn liar as Mort.
Penny looked at Gimlet. She laid one hand on his skinny forearm below the rolled-back shirt sleeve. Softly, she said,
Gimlet, do you have any idea why Becca was shot?
Gimlet dropped the gaze of his one eye to the floor and shifted his weight uneasily from one foot to the other.
Please, Gimlet, tell me. I want to know,
begged Penny. Gimlet nodded slowly.
I know. That's what made me fear for you.
He stopped, and Penny said,
go on.
Gimlet drew a deep breath, as if in telling the girl what he knew, he were leaping into a bottomless pit filled with icy water.
I'm the one that got her killed.
Penny awaited, knowing that when he enlarged on that amazing statement, it would be vastly modified.
I couldn't help it, though. I don't know where Becky learned that a pack of killers from all parts of the state was being brought to jobs here so they could hide while they stole horses and cattle from outside the basin. She knowed it, though, and sent me with a note into Captain Blythe at Red Oak. I gave him the note and left, like she told me to do. I don't know how the crooks here learned about it, but they sure as hell was ready when the Texas Rangers rid through that gap. They wiped him out of plenty.
But there'll be other Rangers coming to see what happened to them.
And alibis and lies a plenty waiting for them same. By the time the next Rangers get here, there won't be a damn thing for them to see. The stolen cattle have new brands, and the crooks is hiding here will be hiding where they can't be found. No one will know nothing about nothing.
Penny nodded slowly, realizing the truth in what old Gimlet said.
If it's known by the crooks that you know what's going on, they'll do to you the same as they done to Becky. As for me, I'm expecting to get killed most any time now.
You said there wasn't anything you could put your finger on, Gimlet. Seems to me you know just about all there is to know.
Say, can't prove nothing, though. Besides that, I don't know where Bright stands.
I wish I knew that, said Penny thoughtfully.
Well, things for sure, though. Long as he's here, there won't be no harm to come to you. Let him get killed, though, as I know damn well he's expecting, and God knows what'll happen. Another thing I don't know is who's bossing things.
Vince?
Gimlet shook his head.
Too cussed for any man to take orders from him.
Mort?
Again the old man's head moved slowly from one side to the other.
I don't think so. We can figure Jeb and Wally out as a matter of course. Maybe they know what's going on. Maybe they don't. Jeb don't have the brains of a jackass, and Wally ain't hardly ever home.
Has he returned from town yet?
Nah. He left the Tomcat around some more, maybe, and found a woman to raise Becky's kids. He ain't come back yet.
Where have the other men gone?
They moseyed out soon after the Baron. I don't know where they went. Vince and some of them are in the front room of the house.
Who's with Vince?
Sawtell and Lombard and the man that talked with Bright the other night, Lonergan. They've been chewing the rag in there ever since Bright took Mort away.
Gimlet turned to the huge stove and shoved a pan back from the heat.
You sure you won't eat?
Penny felt that food would just choke her. She wondered if there were anyone in the world to whom she might turn in confidence and trust. And just then the door swung open suddenly, and Yuma stood in the opening. The big blonde cowboy's face was grim. He glanced at Gimlet and then at the girl.
I saw your horse in the corral, he explained. I got to ask just one thing, Miss Penny.
Penny nodded without speaking. She noticed that Yuma wore two guns, both tied low. His hat was well down on his forehead, and he had a leather jacket over his shirt. He seemed to be dressed for a considerable ride.
Just one thing,
he repeated ponderously.
Well, what is it?
I'm fixin' to pull up stakes here, the cowboy said. You don't know me very well, and you got no reason to trust me except that I tell you I'm on the level. I know what I'm saying will sound crazy loco, and you won't pay no attention to it, but I'm wantin' to take you into Red Oak and see you out of this hell basin. There's folks there that'll make you right to home. You could teach school if you wanted. Will you leave with me right now?
Of course not,
retorted Penny. Yuma nodded slowly.
That's what I figured. I'll be there, though, if you ever need me.
Penny could never know how Yuma had steeled himself to make the extravagant suggestion. The cowboy knew there wasn't a 1 in 1,000 chance that Penny would agree. And when he saw the scornful look, he had no more to say, no argument to put forth. He had made his request, and it had been turned down. His simple and straightforward way of thinking hadn't grasped the thing in the same way that Penny did. He knew the girl was in a dangerous place, and wanted to take her from it and make her safe. She refused to go. That was all there was to it. The door closed behind Yuma, and Penny was about to voice her indignation, but Gimlet spoke first. The old man said more soberly than he'd spoken before.
Miss Penny, you should have gone with Yuma.
Why, the nerve of that crazy cowboy. I don't even know his real name. He's been here only a short time. He's fought twice with Uncle Bryant and told me what he thought of the only man in the world I ever cared for, my uncle. And now he expects me to leave home and go off to Red Oak and teach school? Leave here tonight with him? It is the most ridiculous, outlandish nonsense that I...
Penny stopped for breath. Gimlet said again,
You should have gone with him.
I should have, huh? Retorted Penny. I'd have to be gagged and hogtied to go with that crazy wrangler, and even then I'd fight every inch of the way.
She turned abruptly and pushed through the door into the living quarters of the house. Gimlet blinked when the door slammed almost in his face. He fingered his mustache reflexively and hummed through his knobbly nose.
Gagged and hogtied, huh? Gee-raps! But maybe that was a good idea.
He hurried across the kitchen in a busybody sort of stride and followed Yuma into the darkness. Penny hoped to get upstairs into her bedroom without having to talk to anyone any further. Her mental state was at its lowest depth of despondency she'd ever known. It seemed the more she learned, the more it became futile to look ahead to happiness in Bryant's Basin. Her nerves felt drawn to a tension that threatened to snap them like catgut drawn too tightly on a violin. It seemed as if nothing that could happen now made a great deal of difference. She turned a corner of the hall and stopped. At the foot of the stairs stood Vince Cavendish. At the sight of his cousin, Vince's shoulders seemed to droop, and his eyes assumed a woebegone expression that was something new. He advanced to the girl and said,
"God knows what's going to happen to us, cousin."
Penny had never heard Vince speak in that sort of tone. She looked at him suspiciously, wondering what was behind the beaten manner that was like a plea for sympathy. She moved her hand behind her as Vince sought to take it in his own.
"What's the matter with you? You act like a sick calf."
"Double-crossed," Vince said hollowly. "Double-crossed by Uncle Bryant. He sold out the lot of us."
Penny recalled some of the things Gimlet had told her.
"How?"
"I already signed. The men are upstairs now getting Jeb's name on the paper. They'll get yours when they come down."
"My name to what paper?"
"Well, that Bryant had drawn up,"
went on Vince in a melancholy voice.
"We got to sign away any claim we might have on the ranch as his heirs. He wants to leave it to someone else."
"Who?"
Vince shook his head.
"Don't know."
"Why didn't Uncle Bryant tell us to sign the agreement or whatever it is?"
"Left it to some of the men to handle. He's gone into Red Oak with Mort. Reckon they're waiting there for the boys to get the paper signed and bring it to them there."
"I'm not signing a thing until I talk to Uncle Bryant," said Penny flatly. "In the meantime, I'm going to bed."
Vince shook his head slowly.
"You can't."
"And who's going to stop me?"
"Sawtell and Lombard and Lonergan will be done with Jeb in a few minutes. They'll see that you sign somehow."
Penny turned to go upstairs, but Sawtell's stocky figure appeared at the top of the flight. His voice was soft and smooth to match the bland expression on his wide face.
"Miss Cavendish,"
he said as he started back down the stairs,
"I'm glad you're back. We've something to talk about."
"You've nothing to talk about with me,"
said the girl to the descending man.
"Any business you have for Uncle Bryant can wait until he gets back."
Sawtell smiled.
"I guess you don't understand. He won't be back here until we take some documents to him with your name and the names of your cousins signed to them."
He halted at the bottom of the flight and took a folded paper covered with close writing from his pocket.
"Shall we go into the other room?"
he said.
"You can do what you want. I'm going to bed,"
retorted the girl, starting once more. Sawtell gripped her arm.
"Let go of me."
"I don't want to use any harsh methods, Miss Cavendish,"
Sawtell said with his smile gone and an impatient edge to his voice,
"but I promise you, you're going to sign the agreement so we can start for town as soon as possible."
Becky jerked her arm free. She felt panicky, helpless, but dared not show it. Her gun was still on the belt around her waist, but the cartridges it held were somewhere in the brush on Thunder Mountain. She was determined to get to her room, bar the door, and stay there until her uncle came home. No matter what Bryant did, she knew that he would let nothing serious happen to her. It was incredible he'd left instructions such as Vince had told her about with men like Sawtell and Lombard. She wondered about Lombard and Lonergan. Gimlet had said they were in the house. Upstairs? It was possible. The girl looked toward the front door, and then at Sawtell.
"It's no use putting us all to an odd of extra trouble,"
Sawtell told her.
"You'll only make it harder for yourself."
"He's right,"
put in Vince in a resigned voice.
"They ain't no use putting off signing that paper. Might as well do it and get it done with."
Penny's jaw was firm.
"I won't do anything until I talk to Uncle Bryant."
Sawtell nodded slowly.
"All right, then. We'll have to bring Jeb down here."
He called curt orders up the stairs, and in a moment, Jeb, struggling between Lonergan and Lombard, was practically carried down the stairs. His eyes were wide and staring, and his lean face white with terror.
do what they want," he cried to the girl. "Gorsh, no matter what it is, you sign it like what I done. If you don't, they'll brand me with a poker."
"Take him to the fireplace," ordered Sawtell. "Put some ropes around him, then come back for Vince. This girl will do what Bryant says, or she'll see slow murder with lots of pain."
"No, no," cried Vince. "Not me."
As if by magic, a gun appeared in Sawtell's hand.
"You," he said, "as well as Jeb."
Penny watched the wide-eyed Jeb and the cringing, wincing Vince being dragged, howling, to the fireplace, where Lombard and Lonergan tossed ropes about them. The two were jerked off their feet and stretched out on the floor, and more ropes looped about their ankles, making them helpless. Sawtell, gun in hand, watched the procedure, unmoved and expressionless. Lonergan's black eyes reflected the leaping flames when he faced Sawtell. His black mustache, so carefully brushed and tapered, seemed to twitch with his eagerness to make the next move. Sawtell nodded, and the former gambler grabbed the poker in lean fingers and shoved it deep among the red-hot coals. Stark terror from their souls showed in the eyes of the captured men. Vince drooled supplications for mercy, begging Penny to sign Bryant's agreement and save him from the torture of the heated iron. Jeb wailed conglomerate quotations, misquoted, from Scripture. Sawtell approached Penny.
"You have a few minutes to think it over, while the iron gets red hot. You ever heard a man scream with the pain of being branded?"
He paused and lowered his voice and added,
"In the eyes."
Chapter 16. One Eye Sees Death. The Lone Ranger stood close to his horse at the edge of the basin where thick foliage marked the beginning of the rise of Thunder Mountain. He strained his eyes and ears to detect what he could in the basin. Motionless and tense, the masked man waited like a hunter that tried to catch a scent from a wind that held his breath. He heard the usual night sounds of cattle, katydids, and frogs. There was an occasional call from a creature of the forest that rose behind him. Nothing more. On the downward path, the masked man had met no one. He had dismounted on several occasions to examine the trail by matchlight, and near the bottom, where it was overgrown with weeds, he had lit a candle to inspect it further. He found that many head of cattle had traveled where the path was smooth, but the beef had been fanned out in many directions near the bottom of the mountain and driven into the basin at several points. He decided that this had been done so that a path would not be seen from the basin itself. The Lone Ranger guided Silver back among the trees where the white coat wouldn't be so obvious if someone rode near. He whispered softly, then left the horse untethered. He paused to make sure that his mask was snugly in place. It had become so much a part of him that he couldn't be sure of its presence unless he felt it with his hand. When Tonto had at first suggested wearing the mask all the time, he had thought it was a bit dramatic, perhaps even silly, but consideration made him realize that he already was hampered by the determination not to shoot to kill, by great odds, and by the weakness of his wounds and recent fever. He might have to fight, to rope, and shoot, and the mask must not be a handicap. He checked his guns, making sure they were fully loaded, by replacing the shell that had been used to disarm Rangoon. Then he was ready. An experienced black cat stalking a nervous bird could be no more quiet than the Lone Ranger as he moved across the basin. His clothing had no flapping superfluities. He wore no jingling spurs. His guns were tied down so that the holsters would not slap on his legs. His boots were oiled to preclude the slightest possibility of any squeaking leather. He moved swiftly and surely toward the buildings of the ranch. He saw the house and, not far from it, the row of lighted squares that marked the bunkhouse. Halfway to the buildings, the Lone Ranger froze. He wondered if his eyes were playing tricks or if he had actually seen someone or something move at one end of the bunkhouse. Now he saw a moving figure in the beam of light that slanted from a rear window. In an instant, whatever he saw was obscured by the darkness. He glanced over his shoulder. Silver was well out of sight. His own dark clothing would be barely visible unless somebody was quite close to him. Then he heard the sound of hooves. A horse and rider appeared as a vague shadow against the lighted bunkhouse windows. The masked man dropped flat on his stomach, hugging the ground as closely as possible. The rider was coming straight toward him. He drew a pistol, holding it in readiness if he should be seen. He knew that his hat was light and might attract attention, but he dared not move it. He felt the ground tremble with the beat of the hooves, and he heard the crack of a quirt, cruelly applied, and a man's husky voice. Now the rider was almost upon him, without slackening his speed. The racing horse looked tremendous as it passed within 20 feet of the Lone Ranger. It was impossible to tell who was in the saddle. All details were shrouded by the darkness. But whoever that horseman was, he was in a hurry. He swept across the basin toward the foot of Thunder Mountain, and the last the masked man saw was the barely perceptible shadow breaking through the underbrush that hid the uphill trail. The Lone Ranger presently rose to his feet, waiting several seconds, and then moved ahead again. This time his destination was the bunkhouse. He could call on Bryant and Penelope later. First he would investigate to learn, if possible, the reason for the unknown rider's sudden departure. There was no sound from the bunkhouse. The masked man advanced toward the side of the long and rather narrow one-story building. The rear from which the unknown rider had started was on his right, the front of the building on his left. He could see that a door which opened out was wide, but from his point of view the Lone Ranger couldn't see the inside of the place. He could hear something going on inside the ranch house a couple of 100 feet away, but couldn't distinguish the sounds clearly enough to know what they might mean.
"I'll go there later on," he muttered.
With increasing caution, he approached the objective until his back was pressed close to the slab side of the bunkhouse, at the corner between the lit windows and the open door. Still, there was no sound inside. His gun in readiness, he rounded the corner and looked in the door. He saw a well-lit room, double-deck bunks lined each of the side walls, divided by a narrow aisle. In the front part of the room, there was one large table and several chairs. At least 20 men slept here. But now there was no one in sight. The table had held a poker game, which seemed to have been interrupted suddenly. Freshly dealt cards lay face down on the table as they had fallen, before the chairs of the players. The room was littered with battered pictures, extra boots, blanket rolls, and other paraphernalia that would naturally be accumulated by those who slept there. The Lone Ranger stepped inside and drew the door shut behind him. At the poker table he paused and examined a few of the cards. Riffling through them, he came across two aces. He held these cards close to a coal oil lamp and studied their backs. In one corner he found a barely discernible indentation that might have been made by a fingernail. He nodded slowly.
"Looks like it might be Slick Lonergan,"
he mused. Slick hadn't been seen in any of his familiar haunts since the time he had disappeared before a trial in which he was to be questioned about a murder. The Lone Ranger knew Lonergan's entire background. Crooked gambler, crafty lawyer, and shrewd schemer, who should have been jailed a long time ago, but who had repeatedly found loopholes that served as rat holes for him to slip through and remain free. Leaving the table, the Lone Ranger began a quick but systematic search of the building. He moved down the aisle, studying the possessions near each bunk. He found a handbill that had Rangoon's picture on it, but the name at the time of its printing was Abe Larkin. Larkin apparently hadn't taken any pains to hide the fact that he was wanted by the law. Once he thought he heard a faint, low moan from somewhere close at hand. He stood attentive, but the sound was not repeated. He continued in his search, oppressed by a somewhat guilty feeling as a prowler and an unexplainable sensation that there was someone else in the bunkhouse with him. He studied two more bunks and then heard the moan again. This time it was unmistakable. The Lone Ranger hurried to the far end of the bunkhouse, and there in the lower bunk on his right he found a man unconscious. The window over the head of the still form was open. It was outside this window that the unknown rider had been first seen. The unconscious man, The Lone Ranger could see in the dim light that he was old, was shadowed by the shelf-like bunk of the second tier. The Lone Ranger unhooked a lamp that swung from the ceiling and placed it so that the light fell across the bald head, which lay in a widening pool of red. He jerked his bandana from a pocket and soused it in a nearby water pitcher. Then he bathed the old fellow's face. A tremulous, soft sob broke through the white mustache. The eyes of the wounded man fluttered slightly and then stared up. There was an empty socket where the left eye should have been, but the other eye was bright with pain.
"Take it easy,"
the Lone Ranger whispered.
"I'm going to have to look at that wound and see what we can do for you. Don't try to speak just yet. Wait just a little."
He turned the old man gently on his side and saw the handle of a knife protruding from high up on one shoulder. The blade was out of sight. The Lone Ranger didn't touch the knife. There was no use. The wound was fatal. Gimlet, at best, had only a few minutes left to live. He applied more water to the old man's face and forehead.
"Tell me, if you can, who did this," he said.
Gimlet's lips moved feebly, but no words came.
"Do you know who stabbed you?"
asked the Lone Ranger.
"One word, just the name of the man. Can you tell me that?"
Gimlet lifted one hand very feebly and pointed toward the open window. The Lone Ranger nodded.
"I know he stabbed you through the window. Tell me who he was."
The dying man seemed to be gathering himself for one supreme effort. He swallowed hard. His eyelids closed and then opened.
"Dread," he said, and then coughed and started again. "I tried to get you his bunk air."
More coughing choked the words. Blood drooled from the side of the old man's mouth and stained his white mustache. The Lone Ranger pressed water from his handkerchief against Gimlet's lips.
"I heard you,"
he said softly.
"I heard what you said. You tried to get Yuma. Yuma is a man who works here?"
Gimlet nodded.
"You said this was his bunk."
Again, the slowly moving head went up and down.
"Tell me some more. What about Yuma?"
"Fell of his bunk, looking to see."
Gimlet had to pause for a fit of coughing, so violent that it hardly seemed his fast-ebbing strength could stand it. When he finished, his breath came in short, painful gasps.
"The house,"
he managed to say. He struggled hard, fighting the grim specter every step of its advancing way. There was more he wanted desperately to tell. The old man was upon that borderline between the living and the dead. From his position, he seemed to see things in their true light. He looked beyond the mask and saw a man he knew could be trusted. His gnarled, blue-veined hand clutched that of the Lone Ranger, while he fought hard to make a last statement. The masked man leaned close to him to catch the dying words, if they were uttered. But whatever Gimlet was about to say went with him across the last threshold. His hand clutched convulsively and then relaxed. He coughed once and brought a flood of his life's blood to his mouth, and then he lay back. The masked man felt and found no pulse. He closed the old man's fingers and laid them across the bony chest.
"Yuma,"
he muttered.
"This was Yuma's bunk. I wonder who Yuma is and where I'll find him."
His thoughts came to a lurching halt when a sharp voice snarled a curse with cataclysmic violence.
"You damn murdering skunk! I'll kill you for this!"
It was Yuma who shouted from the doorway.